And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg. I am joined in Zoom conference by The Athletic's Mets beat writer Tim Britton. And Tim, I was just coming to appreciate all of the things I think Jhenasree Vargas can bring to this team. And now he, too, is injured.
Yeah, I mean, it's the curse of center field for the Mets, who have lost Brandon Nimmo, Albert Almora Jr., Kevin Pillar, and Jhenasree Vargas in short order in center field, leading Steve Cohen to tweet out, does anybody want to suit up for the Mets? It is May 25th as we record this. The Mets are on their fifth string center fielder, who is Cameron Maben, who is 0-for-19 in the major leagues this season with the Mets, with 11 strikeouts. He is 4-for-58 in professional baseball this season, because he was off to a rough start in AAA with the Cubs before the Mets got him for reportedly $1. So that is where they are.
He's also not really defensively someone you want playing center field every day. I mean, I'm sorry to say it, like earlier in his career, maybe, but he's not. He is the guy they have playing center field, but I don't know that we could really call him a center fielder at this point.
Right. That is another issue, that he's not exactly Juan Lagares chasing down balls in center field. You know, Juan Lagares.
What's Juan Lagares up to? He's on the Angels. Is he around? Is he available?
He is starting for the Angels. That's the problem.
He's got a
full time job himself currently. So the Mets, you know, it was interesting on Monday to chat with Zach Scott, you know, his usual like start of homestand press conference. And he, you know, I think he gave some firmer timelines than we'd been getting from Luis Rojas, in part because the team was back in New York. They can kind of do a little bit more medically in New York than they could on the road. But I think the big news out of that was that, you know, the timeline for both Michael Conforto and Jeff McNeil is probably at least another month. You know, late June is what Scott said. He called them significant hamstring strains. We had talked about it on the podcast that I thought, you know, based off of what the injuries looked like, that doesn't surprise me so much with Conforto, but I thought McNeil would be back before then. So that kind of puts more of a crunch on them. This is a team that in 2018 and in 2019 kind of collapsed in June. In 2018 in particular, I think they went 5-21 in June that year, which is like the worst record I've ever seen a team have in a month. And that basically subverted their entire season in both of those years. They were able to bounce back a little bit in 19, but you know, you always wondered what would have been had they survived June to a different extent. And now you've got June coming up, and like you're trying to plan for, you're not going to have your best roster for most of that month. How are you going to get by? And that's the task for Zach Scott and the Mets in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, I want to see the team get out of May first. It's very easy, and we say this, you know, speaking so gloomily as we have every show for so long now due to these injuries, they're still in first place, and above 500. But it's just so easy to imagine this particular incarnation of the New York Mets ripping off like 11 straight losses. They've got three in a row right now, as we've mentioned. So many guys, and you mentioned the sort of the grim news on Conforto and McNeil. Brandon Nimmo's rehab had to be shut down. We don't really know exactly when he'll be back. Still no sign of Carlos Carrasco coming back. They said Noah Syndergaard, while he's pitching, they want to get him five starts before he comes back. There is not a Pete Alonso. I don't think that we've spoken since Pete Alonso went on the disabled list. Like, there is just the injuries are piling up, and outside of just a few of them, there's not a lot of obvious light at the end of the tunnel.
Right. You can kind of see Alonso and JD Davis could be back by the time the team is in Arizona or at least San Diego next week. You know, a lot of people have wondered, like, why, you know, the Mets have talked about playing JD Davis a little bit at first base in Syracuse. And I think the fan base reaction has been like that he's in Syracuse only to work on first base. He's not healthy enough currently to return. So that's why he's still down in Syracuse. The hope is for him to string together some 9-inning performances. You know, I think the thought was he had played 9 innings on Saturday and hit a home run. If he had come back on Sunday and done that again, maybe he would have been back in New York on Monday. But he had a stiff neck on Sunday, missed the game that day. Every minor league team always has Monday off. So now you're probably starting over with him. Like, maybe he plays Tuesday and Wednesday 9 innings, and then maybe he's back by Friday at the earliest. Alonso's eligible Saturday. I'm guessing they would push that to at least Monday when they're on the road because they want him to play a little bit in a rehab setting beforehand. So I think when you think about, like, what this team is going to look like over time, you can say, okay, Alonso and Davis should be back by like June 1st. Seth Lugo should be back by that point as well. But what really concerns you, I think, going forward is the outfield because, you know, you don't have a strict timeline for Nimmo. Zach Scott talked about how he's basically got to manage the pain of a nerve issue in his finger, which is like, that's not a thing you want to hear.
It's not good.
You never want to
hear a nerve issue.
You don't want to hear a nerve issue or you've got to manage the pain. So those are not great signs for Nimmo.
Don't I know it? Yeah.
And you know, Conforto and McNeil, who, you know, McNeil has obviously been their second baseman this year, but a guy who, if they needed to, they could plug into left or right field, are not going to be back for a little while. So it's, you know, we don't know. Kevin Pillar and Albert Almora Jr., we haven't heard time. You know, they're not doing anything beyond playing. You know, Almora's playing catch. Pillar
just had surgery.
Surgery last week. And is doing light non-baseball activities, which describes my daily existence, basically. So, you know, you don't know who's going to play center field or right field over the next several weeks. And that's the question for this team is who can play those two positions for you and not be a black hole offensively? Because, you know, my guess is on Tuesday night, it's going to be Cameron Maybin and Khalil Lee. And that's, those guys have not done a whole lot for them offensively to this point.
Very early in my role as this show's co-host, we talked about players in spring training that we thought might be under the radar candidates. And I brought up Drew Ferguson, a guy who got some time in spring training, early in spring training. And I had sort of seen as a guy who may have been overlooked in his time coming up through the minor leagues. And I believe you pointed out accurately that Drew Ferguson was like 19th on the Mets outfield depth chart at that point. I failed to note that I made that statement while holding a talisman I got from a creepy old man in a curio shop of a monkey's paw. And all of a sudden, it seems like maybe Drew Ferguson is knocking on the door of playing center field for the Mets.
Yeah, I mean, you've got in Syracuse, you've got Drew Ferguson and Mason Williams. Mason Williams, Pawtucket's own Mason Williams.
The former Yankee prospect. He's a center fielder, right?
Yeah, like,
and he's, some of these guys.
He's gotten some major league run and been not terrible. I mean, you've always got to change your, you know, you're not looking for like OPS pluses of 100 and above for players like the, you know, in this situation. You're looking for guys who have, like, they've given you an 89 OPS plus in 150 at bats in the major leagues before. The issue with calling up any of those guys is like they've got a real 40 man crunch because I'm trying to do the math here. They've got 16 guys on the injured list. Five of them are on the 60-day injured list, so they don't count towards the 40-man roster. So that's 11 guys on the injured list, plus your 26 active roster. That's 37. That gives you only 3 extra guys on the 40-man roster. So if you're calling, you know, and some of those guys are guys that are prospects. Well, they're all pitchers who aren't in the major leagues right now. It's Tarpley, it's Sam McWilliams, and it's Thomas Zupacki. Those are not guys you want to designate for assignment so that Mason Williams can play center field for a week. So that's an issue they're running into, is kind of just they've had so many injuries in such a short period of time and so few of them seem like 60-day IL situations. It's almost like you'd prefer it if one or two of those was a bit more serious for you know, one of the backup player. You know, if you're getting a starting center fielder back like Nimmo, then maybe you're okay with Almora missing a longer period of time. But they don't have that situation to 60-day anyone at this point. So they might end up having to do that. But they've got to juggle a lot of different things, and they're probably going to lose some players that they like. We've already seen them lose, like Daniel Zamora to Seattle and Trevor Hildenberger to San Francisco. They've lost some players who they've DFA'd, and that's probably going to continue if they need to keep making roster space for players.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely the case, but all of these guys they have added to the 40-man roster in the past couple of weeks, a lot of them can probably safely be DFA'd. Like, you know, with all due respect to Cameron Maben, I'm not sure how concerned you are about losing a guy you got for, I don't know about the dollar thing. You got for cash considerations. Not that I don't believe it. I just it feels mean to even say it. But you know, Cameron Maben was a guy who was available, and there are guys like Cameron Maben available, and I think that there's a route to making him available again, which doesn't really kill the Mets moving forward, right? Like they have some wiggle room here.
Yeah. You know, once you get a couple of infielders back, you know, if Davis and Alonso are back next week, it's a little easier to designate someone like Wilfredo Tovar, because you'd have Peraza and VR and Davis and Lindor as middle infielders for you. And then, you know, Luis Guillorme is supposed to start a rehab assignment next week, so he'd be not that far down the road. You'd be able to, you know, it's really just like you've got to protect your outfield at this point. I think that's the concern moving forward, and trying to figure out a way to stabilize it to some extent until you get your bigger pieces back about a month from now.
Yeah, if you DFA Wilfredo Tovar and someone takes him, I think you say, hey, good for Wilfredo Tovar. And you know, happy trails. Unless, of course, it's the Dodgers who take him, in which case you say, like, oh, crap, what did we miss? Now Wilfredo Tovar is going to make the next six All-Star teams. It's not – the problem is – I don't think the problem is finding roster spot so much as it is finding someone worthy of a roster
yes.
spot. And you looked at some of the options in a column for The Athletic this week. And I will say I was uninspired. I was inspired by the writing. It was great. I was uninspired by the options you presented.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to trade for Chris Bryant on May 25th, especially because the Cubs are over 500. So it's really trying to find... You know, it's got to be a perfect storm of three different things. You've got to find a player who is good and useful for you, B, a player who is good and useful for you that happens to be on a team that is totally out of it at this point, which, you know, there's maybe, you can probably point to like 7 to maybe 10 teams that would feel totally out of it. I think there's 7 teams that are 7 or more games out of the playoffs currently. And then you've got to find that guy has to play for a team that's out of it, and that team has to be willing to take the reputational hit of trading him early. Like, you know, one of the guys I listed there was Brock Holt with the Rangers, mm-hmm. who, you know, a guy who was a pretty useful piece for the Red Sox for a long time, actually made an All-Star team in 2015 while playing, I think, every non-pitcher catcher position for the team that year. You know, started on a World Series team, hit for the cycle in the playoffs, like a useful player who can play all over. He's on the Rangers. He's their starting third baseman currently. The Rangers were 500 like 10 days ago, and now they're 10 games under 500. Brock Holt's not going to be the third baseman for them when they're good again. But do they want to trade a guy who's from Fort Worth, who grew up right by the stadium, who's really likable and popular in their clubhouse? Do they want to trade him on May 25th for a 19-year-old lottery ticket prospect? Because that hurts your team dynamic. Like, it's tough for teams to trade players in that situation if they're good and useful, even if they're out of it. Like, it sends a tough message, not just to your fan base, but to your actual roster in mm-hmm. the clubhouse. So that's why, you know, I think the guy that stood out to me most on that list was probably Adam Frazier with the Pirates, because the Pirates, you know, they're not a team that like entered this season thinking like, hey, we could win 75 to 80 games. They knew they were going to be probably the worst team in the National League along with Colorado. They've been that to this point in the season. And Frazier is a guy who's not going to be there when they're good again. He's got a year and a half left on his contract, on his team control. Can play a bunch of different spots. Is playing well now. Probably a bit over his head. His OPS plus was like 138 coming into Tuesday. That's a guy who would make some sense. He's not a great long-term fit for the Mets. He bats lefty. When McNeil and Conforto are back, he's not a part of your everyday lineup. He's probably not a part of your everyday plans in 2022 when he's still under team control, the way some other guys might be if you traded for them now. The way like Brian Reynolds, his teammate, would be if you traded for him now. Right. But you know the Pirates aren't going to trade the 26-year-old guy who can play center field, who's a switch hitter, who's got 4 years of team control left. No, they'll trade you the second baseman slash corner outfielder who's playing over his head and only has a year and a half left. So that's the type of talent I think you're looking for here. That's the ceiling of what you might get on the trade market at this point in time, is my expectation.
And you mentioned, you know, he's not even a center fielder, right? So it makes you think like, okay, like it's kind of, I don't know that, you know, like it always depends on the deal, but like, I don't know how much you're going to be like digging through prospects to find a trade for Adam Frazier when you're not even going to want to put him in center field once he gets here. Like they need someone who can defend that position.
Yeah.
Because it's a big one.
And you know, we've talked about it in this past offseason and in offseasons going back for years with the Mets is, you know, oh, like Brandon Nimmo's a better fit in a corner outfield spot. Let's find a center fielder who works, who plays both ways and brings value. And there's just not many of them. You know, you're really picking between sacrificing defense for offense there or vice versa. The Mets have chosen to sacrifice defense in the past. And Nimmo's actually been okay there so far this year. I think better than he was last year for sure. But there's just not that many guys available. And when you run through four of them in a month, and they're not the only team that's running through center field. You know, the White Sox have lost Luis Robert. The Yankees have lost Aaron Hicks. There's other teams that can use center fielders. The Angels lost this dude who plays center field for them, Mike Trout.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, hey, do you want Juan Lagares? No, he's already starting in center field for a different major league team currently. There's real scarcity at that position, you know, even more so than like we're used to talking about with catcher, that it's really hard to find a guy that you can just throw out there to be competent defensively and hit 220 for you, really.
Right. And I think at this point, as a Mets fan, I would happily take a guy who's not going to hit, who can at least play defense out there. But because if with Maben, I'm sorry to say, you're not getting a lot of both. Right. It's not like, oh, like Nimmo, where we can handle a little bit of defensive inadequacy because he's going to hit so well. I don't know that you're getting like and even with Jhenasree Vargas, I think you could say like, hey, like, you know what? Like, he's not going to hit a ton, but like he has the range for center field. I mean, we saw that he made that incredible catch. It looked like he got a good jumps on balls. Right now, it doesn't seem like they have either of those things. And I just feel like you got to be able to find one. Right, you got to be able to find one.
Yeah, and I'll continue looking.
I just went down to Double A right now. at the Binghamton Rumble Ponies are playing in center field. Wagner LaGrange, which is a real name of a guy who's not from a Western. He has a 646 OPS and a 276 on base percentage. I have no idea if he can defend center field. And Desmond Lindsay, a guy who was a bigger prospect for the Mets a few years ago, but he is off to a miserable offensive start. He is 3-for-29, although two of his three hits have been doubles. But a 103 batting average, a 385 OPS. So it's not like there's some obvious fit from within the system. And so I guess I will hold out hope for Drew Ferguson, who I believe can be the second coming of Jeff Duncan.
Oh, God. Jeff Duncan and Brandon Tyner. Remember those were
Jason
the
Tyner.
Days.
Jason Tyner.
Sorry, yes,
yeah.
Jason Tyner.
Jason Tyner got a couple major league years. I mean, I think it was with the Rays, but I think he had a few seasons. Like he had a viable major league career, sort of. But yeah, that was those were the days.
Was it Jeff Duncan who had like back to back two hit games to start his career?
He
was going to be really good, and then he was like within a week he was hitting 100 again.
Yes, It was a little bit longer than that. I want to say it was like a 10-game stretch where he had like a 600 on base percentage because he had a bunch of hits, but he also was just walking a ton, and it was I remember talking about it in my friend Eric's backyard, and so I know it would have been like 2003 or 2004. I want to say it was 03 when they called up Duncan. He had like 10 games, and it was like peak Moneyball era, like when everybody was fully aware of like the value of walks, and Jeff Duncan came up and was just like walking every single time. And I guess eventually the pitchers figured out, like, maybe we should just throw the ball over the plate to Jeff Duncan. And all of a sudden he went in the tank.
Yeah. The 2002 to 2004, that was a dark period.
Yeah. It was, luckily it was like, especially the 2004 is like the 1 year of my life, really. Like since 1986, when I was too young to really follow the team, 2004 is like the 1 year I was in a band, and I was doing other stuff. I was like, I just wasn't that tapped into the Mets. So people refer to stuff that happened in 2004, and it's like, nope, I don't. That's the 1 year I just don't remember anything. And I feel like I picked a good year to skip.
Yeah, like 2010 to 2014. So I was covering other baseball teams, which means it's hard to watch the Mets play baseball.
Yeah.
And so that is all just like one big long single season to me. It's like, they were playing Ruben Tejada at short the whole time. Lucas Duda was the number four hitter the entire time, playing every different position. And they had a different catcher every year. And Dylan G was part of the rotation the entire time. And that is those teams to me. Like, I'm not able to differentiate between them the way I could give you, like, you know, really big distinctions between 99 and 2000 or 06 and 07.
I mean, I could spend a lot of time talking about the 2010, and by 2013 I was at USLA, but 2007 to 2012 Mets when I was at SNY, I could tell you the distinctions between the 2010 and 2011 teams for sure. But the Mets are again hard to watch, so there is a connection to that era. Except there is such good news, and we've danced around it a little bit. We're speaking on Tuesday morning, and a momentous occasion we have been awaiting for is set to occur. And I knock on wood and I cross my fingers, because a lot can happen between Tuesday morning when we record this and 7:10 p.m. on Tuesday evening when the Mets play. But there is at least one little bit of very good news.
What is it?
Well, Jacob DeGrom's going to pitch.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. Jacob DeGrom is pitching on Tuesday.
I was like, oh no, did I get this wrong? Is he pitching next Tuesday?
You never know with the way things have gone. You know, DeGrom, I think to get really comfortable as a Mets fan, you'd have to see him like go out and pitch seven innings and be okay. And
not walk off in the fifth, you know? Yeah.
Right.
I mean, obviously. Yeah.
But I looked this up as a joke for a tweet, was like, oh, you know, like the lineup could really use Jacob DeGrom coming back. But actually, based off like FanGraph's compilation of like offensive value, Jacob DeGrom is the second most valuable offensive player currently healthy on the Mets roster, behind, obviously,
bat him leadoff. I'm not even kidding.
He's behind noted offensive slugger Tomas Nido. Like, those are their two best offensive performers in 2021 who will be on the active roster for Tuesday night's game. So you could make a case for hitting DeGrom.
I was kidding, but I'm kind of kidding, right? I don't know. It's hyperbolic rather than ironic or something, right? Like, he can put the ball in play, and I'm not 100% convinced that many of the other members of the Mets lineup can.
Yeah, you know, if you have Maben and Lee in the lineup, like, you might make a case that like DeGrom should hit ahead of both of them. But his return, like, you know, Luis Rojas has not complained too much about all the injuries. He's kind of, you know, there have been kind of like, yeah, it just keeps happening kind of quotes. The only player that he's like explicitly missed is Jacob DeGrom. You know, I think at one point when they had won, I forget if it was the game in Miami, that went 12 innings, or one of the wins in Atlanta. You know, every win that they have feels like it takes so much out of them to get it at this point, where he was just like, you know, and we're doing this without Jacob DeGrom. We miss Jacob DeGrom a lot. Like, it's been tough without Jacob DeGrom. And it's just, you think of how much easier he makes it, not just the night he pitched, and this is with the Mets like not capitalizing fully on what he brings over the last 4 years. But he makes it so much easier that night for them because he is the best pitcher in the world. But also, like, it makes it a little easier the night before because you can use your bullpen a little bit more aggressively. Mm-hmm. And presumably the night after because most of those guys are a little bit rested. So he's one of those pitchers who, while he's only playing once out of every five, he's affecting more games than that because of his your ability to rely on him going deep into games. You know, maybe he's not at that point now because he's coming off the IL. We'll see if he has a pitch count. You know, he only threw, I think it was four innings. Was it three or four innings in the rehab start in St. Louis? I guess three innings, right? Faced 10 guys and struck eight of them out.
I believe you. You would know that better than I would, so I will defer to you.
I'm trying to make sure I don't confuse it with Syndergaard. Syndergaard's was four.
Yeah.
So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if this is a five and out kind of outing for him, or maybe even shorter than that, that, you know, that he's going to be on a tighter pitch count than he would be otherwise. But going forward, having him back, like, I'm less concerned about the rotation because you've got DeGrom coming back. Taiwan Walker doesn't seem like it should be that long an absence.
Yeah, we've said that before. We've said that before.
Yes, yeah.
What happened to Luis Guillorme? Where is he? right, that wasn't going to be that long an absence. And now he's just like, it seems like he's just disappeared.
I mean, I said obliques tend to linger, you know?
Yeah,
which is what's gone on there. And actually, I should note at that point that, you know, Taiwan Walker is dealing with a side issue. That's the same area as an oblique, basically. So maybe that's a bit problematic. But I worry a bit less about their starting rotation than I do, mm-hmm. but just, again, about, like, having three outfielders throw out. The reason Dom Smith is not playing first base is because they just need a warm body who can play the outfield. And Smith has actually played left field quite well. So that's why he's playing there still.
And the pitching's been great. I mean, even without DeGrom, I think you have to give – it's so easy, and we so frequently, like, just kill managers for every bad bullpen decision. It's a lot easier, obviously, when just about everyone in your bullpen is pitching well, but it does feel like Rojas has been largely pushing the right buttons. I think there was some rightful criticism of how quickly he pulled Joey Lucchese over the weekend when Lucchese was finally having a really good outing, but I think – the logical counter argument to that is just like, well, you've seen how Joey Lucchese had done earlier this season, and you'd obviously like to get that guy out of the game on a good note when he's before it's gone awry. And then there was certainly listening to the Mets radio broadcast, they were on Rojas a little bit for leaving Jordan Yamamoto in for as long as he did in Sunday's game, but. Yamamoto did, after allowing the five runs, he did settle in and give him a couple more innings. And it wasn't like he walked a guy and he hit a guy, but it was an infield single or an error and a bloop. It wasn't like he was just getting completely tagged or it didn't feel that way from the radio broadcast. So, I wouldn't get on Rojas for either of those. And I would just say, like, if we blame the manager when it all goes awry with the pitching staff, you got to say this guy's doing a pretty good job cobbling together pretty good pitching performances from a staff that has been decimated by injuries just as – and not quite to the extent that the offense has, but still very much decimated by injuries.
Yeah, I mean, they just went through a turn where they only had two healthy starters. Until DeGrom comes back tonight, it's Stroman and Peterson, basically. And, you know, they entered Monday. I didn't check after the Peterson outing. But their starters ERA was 3.01, which was tied for fourth in baseball. It was the best. The top three teams are all in the NL West in San Diego, LA, and San Francisco. But I think it was tied with the White Sox for the fourth best in baseball. Their staff ERA overall, including the bullpen, was around 3.3. That was also mm-hmm. good for fourth in baseball. So I think that speaks to the depth they've accumulated there, that the bullpen has pitched really well. And, you know, I think we can have our problems with how Rojas has managed individual instances. I didn't have a problem with the Lucchese thing because, like you mentioned, like, I think earlier, one of the issues was that they weren't getting him out quickly enough because things have snowballed on him. Like, you look at it, I actually did the math the other day, and I'm going to try to pull it up here. Because one of the things I like to look at, and we mentioned it last time or two, was like the percentage of 1-2-3 innings that guys have. And Lucchese... actually has, I opened the wrong file, sorry. I think it's like 42% of his innings have been 1-2-3 innings. And it's like once he allows someone on base, Yeah, it is 42. Oh, good on me. 42% of his innings have been 1-2-3 innings. And when he does allow a guy on base, it generally leads to like a three-run inning. And so he was getting close to that third turn through the order that has been an issue for him in the past. I was fine with that when you had, they didn't lose that game because they took Joey Lucchesi out at that stretch. I was also fine with Yamamoto because at that point, I feel like that game was kind of lost already. You're just trying to look for innings when you've got...
Once you let up five runs, when you have no one who can hit, like, if that's it. Like, even in Monday night's game, when they went down three, you're like, this is over. Like, yeah, it's unfortunate, but it's really hard to envision the Mets scoring three runs against Austin Gomber.
Yeah, like, you know, their record is so good. It's, what, 17-4 or something like that when they score at least four runs, which, like, the thing that really jumps out at you is like, oh, man, half their games, they're not scoring even four runs.
Yeah.
And over the last 10, where they're 3-7, I think they've scored 29 runs. So under three per game, it's four in the last three games. And that was, you know, with the big uprising last night in the later innings Monday night with the solo home runs from McCann and Drury. Actually, I said earlier that I thought Maben and Lee would be playing in the outfield. It wouldn't surprise me if we see like Brandon Drury playing in the outfield. He would have been there in extra innings on Monday night. Maybe that's a way to try to get a little bit more pop in there. But those are the kinds of things they have to start considering just because the offense has been so so quiet.
Maybe James McCann can play center field. I mean, he was inserted at first base despite never having played it. Rojas was like, yeah, he's familiar with it, which is like, everyone's familiar. Like, I'm familiar with first base, right? But I can't play it in a major league game. And then McCann made a brilliant play in like the first inning.
Yeah, like ranging so far, like that was, he made a play at what is conventional second base, essentially.
Yeah, it was like a gold glove caliber defensive play. Like, and so I was like, if I were him, I would be like, I'm never playing first base again in my life. Just let me live with that one, and everyone can go on thinking I might be a first base defense savant.
Yeah, like he should have just pulled the George Costanza raised hand, said, I'm out, that's it.
Right.
I'm doing one for one.
Yeah.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
We got a question from listener Doug, and this is an interesting one. He brings it up. You wrote a profile of Zach Scott back in the Halcyon days when the Mets only had like 15 guys on the disabled list. You had a nice profile of GM Zach Scott for The Athletic. You mentioned in it, and this is what Doug says. He says, in it, Tim talked about Scott's involvement in the Red Sox deliberations about whether to trade Nomar Garciaparra at the trade deadline in 2004, but Tim did not share what position Zach took on that trade in those meetings. I'd love to know where he stood at the time and why.
Yeah, so I'm taking Zach's word on this, but his conversation about that was that he was pro trading Nomar Garciaparra at the trade deadline in 2004, not just because he had a gig to get to down the block to play the harmonica for the band Buddhahead later that night at Paradise Rock Club, but he had done a lot of his work at like Diamond
Mine. Wait, he was in a band called Buddhahead.
So he was not like a set member of the band, but when the band, like, he had a high school buddy who was in the band who played the bass, and when they were in New England or New York, a lot of times Scott would join them for a couple songs. They had actually written a song for Zach Scott to play the harmonica on, and then because their record label also had John Popper, who is the only harmonica player that I think anyone can name.
No, Toots Thielemans. great jazz musician, harmonica player. But go on. I've got deep. Like I could get some deep jazz pulls when I mean,
you were also in a band around 03 and 04, I have learned.
I very much was, yeah. But we weren't called Buddhahead, although we might have been. Yeah, go on.
So because Buddhahead was on the same label as John Popper, you know, the guy from Blues Traveler, that John Popper is the guy who recorded the harmonica part of the song for them. But whenever they toured, they would have Zach come in and play the John Popper part. And actually,
that means you could rip on the harmonica if you can play the John Popper part. So that's pretty impressive.
The members of the band, I reached out to several different members of the band. Buddhahead has since disbanded. His high school friend is no longer in music. They said like he was really really good on the harmonica. Like you know you he was almost as good as John Popper. To play that part. So that was the context of the night, you know, that Scott had something else to get to. And he was just, like, he was an intern in the Red Sox front office. I don't think at that point he had that was his first year in the Red Sox front office. He didn't have like a set position, but front offices were so much smaller then that he's part mm-hmm. of the group having that conversation. And kind of Theo Epstein's style was, well, Zach, you want to make the deal. This other person in the front office doesn't. Why don't you two debate it? The other person might be the assistant general manager who's been in the sport for 20 years, and here's a guy who's in his first year as an intern. And they'd go back and forth. And I think what Scott said was concerning to him with Garcia Parra was like his defensive metrics, because kind of primitive defensive metrics at that time that Tom Tippett at Diamond Mind, who ended up consulting for the Red Sox for a while and who Scott got his first job in baseball with, mm-hmm. like he was very good at developing defensive metrics that were kind of ahead of even the industry at that time. And one of the things that they thought through with defensive metrics is when a guy is getting worse defensively, it usually means an injury is there that you just don't know about yet. And so Garcia Parra's defensive metrics internally had been significantly worse in 2004. So they were concerned about his health the rest of that season and moving forward. So that's why they were a bit more aggressive in shopping him at that time. That's why Scott himself was good with dealing him that July 31st night.
And the deal brought them Orlando Cabrera, who wound up having a really nice half season for them and in the midst of his very long career.
Yeah, I forget exactly how that trade broke down because they got Cabrera and Mankiewicz, but Mankiewicz might have been a different.
It was a three-way deal. It was a three-way deal. I just had it up. They traded. There's like so many names involved in this trade. It was sort of a wild one. And I guess that would have been like the last year of the Expos too, right? So who knows what was mo if was that Omar Minaya making that deal? He was traded by the Red Sox with Matt Merton, and like sort of one of those classic AAA lifer guys who always seem to perform better than most AAA guys and never really got a long major league opportunity. Wound up going overseas, playing pretty well, I think, in Japan. So he was traded with Matt Merton to the Cubs. Garcia Parra, the Twins were in the deal, sent Mankiewicz to the Red Sox. The Expos sent Cabrera to the Red Sox. The Cubs sent Francis Beltran, Alex Gonzalez, and Brendan Harris to the Expos. And the Cubs sent a minor leaguer named Justin Jones to the Twins. So just a ton of guys flying around everywhere. But the main thing for the Red Sox was they gave up Merton and Garcia Parra and got back Mankiewicz and Cabrera.
I always forget that he went to the Cubs first. Like mm-hmm. I always think that I'm always like, yeah, like Garcia Parra was traded to the Dodgers because that's right. Where I remember him being decent a couple of years later when they played the Mets in the NLDS. But and you know, the Red Sox had all of their big trades are with the Dodgers. That's where they sent Manny. That's where they sent Carl Crawford and Josh Beckett yeah. and Adrian Gonzalez. But it was Chicago that year.
Well, it's an interesting question. Thanks to Doug for asking it. What do you think it means now? Do you think it matters now, or is it just an indication that this guy, Zach Scott, didn't appreciate Red Sox history and Nomar Garcia Parra's role therein? Or was he a visionary, or was it just a stroke of good luck that he was on the right side of history there?
I think it speaks to, you know, I talked to Ben Cherington, who was in the Red Sox front office at that time, higher up than Zach was, and eventually became Boston's general manager, and is now in Pittsburgh as the general manager. And he said the strange thing is, like, at that point in time, Zach was like the only objective voice in the room, like the guy who's just leaning on the numbers. Here's what the numbers are saying. And, you know, everyone else had this kind of subjective view. And nowadays, a lot of it is the opposite. You have a lot more objective views, and it's hard to find really good, trustworthy subjective views. But I think it speaks to, like, that's the way he approaches things, and that he can lay out an argument in kind of a rational, well-reasoned way that can sway people who are above him. Now, you know, then it was the entire front office had higher ranking positions. Now it's just Sandy Alderson and I guess Steve Cohen. So there's fewer people to convince if he wants to do something. I think it does speak to, you know, there's not going to be a lot of sentimentality necessarily. I don't know how that plays into what the Mets might do. I don't, you know, there's no equivalent to Nomar Garciaparra currently on their roster, I don't think, at the moment, you know, because Jacob deGrom is still really, really good. I don't know how that plays into it, but, you know, he does not have the connection with the players and the team that he did even in Boston. That was his first season, but he had grown up a Red Sox fan and had followed the team pretty closely for most of his life. So I think he knew what Nomar Garciaparra meant to that fan base to begin with. So I think it just shows that he's going to be objective about things. And I thought it was interesting, like, the urgency that he expressed even yesterday in his press conference was more than you usually get from a general manager at this time of the year.
I like when the Red Sox, as an aside, I like when the Red Sox have players that, like, force the exposure. Nomar Garciaparra being the most classic example of this, that, like, just force the New England accent out. And so I feel like Xander Bogaerts sort of, like, maintains that tradition a little bit.
I loved the Jerry Remy pronunciation of Daniel Naver when he was there. Like it was the way it's all, like, you know, the ARs get just A's and the A's get the R back when they don't have it.
Right. There's no one listening to the game would have had any clue how to spell his last name. If you have a question for the Metrospective podcast, please email it to us or tweet it at us. You can email me at asktedberg@gmail.com. A lot of people seem to appreciate that we offer the email address because not all of our listeners are on Twitter, but if they are, you can get at us at Tim Britton. That's Tim. That's not me. I'm at OG Ted Berg. We have several people who are very excited to hear that we read books. We do read books, and we like feedback of all types. So please rate, review, subscribe wherever you can do those things. Thank you, as always, for listening. Tim, ideally, the next time we speak, we will at least be able to say, like, oh, it's good to have Jacob deGrom back in the rotation.
You're the one with the talisman and the monkey paw and all that.
Do you know that I once asked before a game, I asked Eddie Koons about how he hadn't allowed a home run since, like, his junior year of high school or some ridiculous stat. And then in that game, in, like, the first batter he faced, he allowed a home run, which was, like, then I had to go. I went and apologized to him afterwards. I was just like, I'm so sorry, dude. And he was totally cool about it. But what was worse was then it tanked the video segment that we did about how Eddie Koons hadn't allowed a home run in so many years.
The great example of that on the Mets beat, I have to look up the exact circumstances, but this is years ago. Anthony DiComo had tweeted something about how, like, the Mets have gone are an inning away from setting a major league record or a franchise record for not balking. And then, like, literally 30 seconds later, they balked, which is
that's amazing.
You can never predict amazing. A balk.
That is truly amazing. We will be back later this week. The Mets have two more with the Rockies coming up, and we will certainly talk all about them. Tim, peace out.
Adios.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.